10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, you can view a very, very interesting documentary about one of the most important figures in rock and roll history. In fact, he's often called the father of rock and roll, namely Chuck Berry, a man with brilliant talent, but also someone who at certain points in his life and career was perhaps his own worst enemy. And that's one of the things that is examined in this film, which talks not only about Chuck Berry and his brilliant talent and his extraordinary accomplishments as a musician, but also the backdrop in which he was performing and the ways in which Chuck Berry brought blacks and whites together in rather unprecedented fashion, and the number of white teenagers in the early 1950s who were completely enraptured with Chuck Berry and his music says a lot about his talent, but it also helps explain why he was a man who for so much of his life and career was angry, and rightfully so, at the way in which he was mistreated and disrespected by many figures in the industry. All of that is explored in this film, and also explored in a really fine book that was published back in 2002 called Brown Eyed Handsome Man, The Life and Times of Chuck Berry, in many respects still the definitive biography of Chuck Berry. And its author, Bruce Pegg, is joining me today. He is featured prominently in this new film, which is part of the PBS series In Their Own Words. Bruce Pegg, who has had a kind of a dual career in both academia and in music, even ran his own record label for a time, and originally from Leicester, England, and someone who followed the career of Chuck Berry with great interest and set out to write a incredibly interesting book about him. And again, contributes very significantly to this new film for the PBS series, In Their Own Words, devoted to the great Chuck Berry. Bruce Pegg, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I know from reading a couple entries from one of your blogs that you never had the chance to sit down in any lengthy exchanges with the legendary Chuck Berry, including when you wrote this biography about him. But I know that you did get to see him perform and had a couple of very brief encounters with him. Can you describe those to our listeners?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they were pretty funny in their own right. The first time I met Chuck was very briefly after a concert that he had given up here in upstate New York in at SUNY Geneseo. And during the concert, Chuck was known throughout his life for performing on a cash-only basis. He never trusted promoters all that much. And we noticed, my partner and I, when we watched the show, that he had stuffed a wad of cash in his back pocket, creating a rather large bulge on the back on his backside, which was pretty funny in and of itself. And then after the show, I managed to procure an autograph from him and a copy of his autobiography, which he, when I handed him the book, he deliberately turned the book upside down to sign it for some bizarre reason. The second encounter I had with him was probably even funnier. I met him backstage at Blueberry Hill in St. Louis, which had become a kind of a base for him in his last in the last part of his career. He performed many, many times at that club. At the invitation of Joe Edwards, the club's owner, I managed to meet him backstage very briefly and asked him if he wouldn't mind posing for a photograph, which a friend of mine was going to take. And he saw the camera, noticed that there was going to be a flash taken, and he said, "Nope, I don't want to look at the camera. The flash hurts my eyes." And so I ended up with a pretty hilarious photograph of me and him together, with him looking completely away from the camera. Which, if anybody wants to go onto my website at brucepegg.com, they can see the hilarious results of that encounter. I should have said that. I think both of those encounters sort of show why it was so hard, in fact, impossible for me to get an interview with him for the book. I mean, he basically kept anybody that he did not know at arm's length and was very, very distrustful, I think for very, very good reason, as my book and I'm sure the documentary will point out. You know, he was, you know, just ripped off so many times in his life and career that he just distrusted so many people and just had a very small nucleus of people that he kept around him that he could trust.
You mention in the acknowledgments of your book, Brown Eyed Handsome Man, The Life and Times of Chuck Berry, that not only did he refuse to speak to you, but he had really circled the wagon closely in terms of his mm-hmm. of his family members. I mean, they too, I suppose, in reflection of his wishes, also refused to speak with you, which I'm sure had to be rather heartbreaking for you.
It was very frustrating, and in the end, I sort of had to just throw up my hands and say, you know, I'm just going to write this as if this was somebody that was no longer alive, and just sort of just try to base my my own understanding of him as a man and a kind of character, just based on the evidence that I had in front of me.
So tell our listeners when you first encountered Chuck Berry and his music. What do you recall about that sort of seminal moment when he had such a strong initial impact on you, or was his impact on you something that only took hold gradually over time?
I would say the latter, Greg. I first came across Chuck Berry in the early 1980s, believe it or not. I, as you said in your introduction, I was born and raised in England, and raised on the music of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, as so many people of my age were. And it wasn't until I started to really sort of dig deeper into their careers as I became a little older that I started to realize that they didn't create their music in a vacuum, and everything for them pointed back to, you know, the rock and rollers, and in particular Chuck Berry. And that really started my interest in his life and career. And then a few years later, as you said, I was teaching English at the time, so I, you know, I was used to the academic world of research and writing, and I'd also been involved in music, playing music for many years, and as a solo act and as a guitar player in a cover band, several different cover bands. And one day I realized that so little had been written about Chuck Berry that I decided you know, my skill sets, my ability as an academic researcher could finally come together, and I could write a biography, which at the time when I began was non-existent. There was no biography of Chuck Berry prior to my book. And which was astounding to me, because, as you probably know, there's been volume upon volume written about people like Elvis Presley and Buddy Holly and Richard, but so little had been written about Chuck Berry, and particularly no full-length biography had ever been attempted prior to me writing Brown-Eyed Handsome Man.
Right. And of course, it's even more surprising when one considers not only what an important figure he was in helping to create this thing called rock and roll, but also the fact that his life was so colorful and complicated. I mean, it seems like exactly the kind of figure that would have drawn all kinds of attention from biographers and analysts and critics and so on, and it just didn't happen until your book. He did, however, write an autobiography back in 1986, so some years before your biography appeared. I've never seen that autobiography, and I don't know a whole lot about it. Is it a significant work or and revelatory in any particular way? And how trustworthy was it as a source for your biography?
Well, great question. Was it trustworthy? Probably not. Like all autobiographies and memoirs, there's Chuck only lets you in and sees the things that he wants you to see. As a work of art, however, it is superb. It is told in exactly the same way that he wrote his songs. There's that fabulous wordplay, a great rhythm to the prose, and I would argue it's worth reading and tracking down and reading just for those reasons alone. But in terms of the truth itself, I mean, he stretches things hides things and all that kind of stuff that, like I say, most people that write an autobiography will do.
We're speaking with Bruce Pegg, who is the author of the first definitive biography of Chuck Berry, published back in 2002, called Brown-Eyed Handsome Man, The Life and Times of Chuck Berry. Bruce Pegg is featured prominently in a brand new PBS documentary for the series In Their Own Words. The program is going to air tomorrow night, and it indeed explores both the life and the career of the extraordinary Chuck Berry, often called the father of rock and roll. He was born in 1926 in St. Louis, and he's quoted in the film as saying, "I was born in the best year of my life." Can you help us explain what Chuck Berry probably means by those intriguing words?
Yeah, I love that line. I think really what he's saying is that things for him, particularly as a black man growing up in a segregated society as St. Louis was back in those days, it just made his life harder as he went along. Chuck's childhood was spent in an area of St. Louis called the Ville, which was one of the few areas in St. Louis that black people could own property due to the Race Restrictive Covenant laws that had been enacted for property transactions at the time. And so he grew up really in an Afrocentric, African-American-centric culture that I think was great for him in the sense that he got the sense that black families and black people could achieve so much. I mean, that whole area was full of black entrepreneurs and, barbershops and theaters and even a huge teaching hospital. So it seemed, I would think as a child it would have seemed like his future would be limitless. And then Chuck, once he steps foot outside of those confines of the Ville, he finds out that that life is not quite so hospitable. And he tells a story. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, in your book, you describe the Ville, this place where he grew up, as a self-contained island of black enterprise and culture in a vast, white, segregated ocean. That's a nice turn of phrase, and I think it's important for us to understand what this place was like and its great promise. And then, as you're about to tell us, that would be promise certainly not fully realized once you stepped away from the Ville.
Absolutely, and he tells the story in the movie Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, which was filmed at the Fox Theater in St. Louis in 1986 to celebrate his 60th birthday. He tells the story about being turned away from that very same theater when his father had taken the family to go and attempt to go and see the movie Tale of Two Cities in 1935. And they were turned away from the box office because they simply did not want to sell tickets to a black family. And, you know, the wonderful moment, I think, in the Hail Hell rock and roll movie, and it was so wonderful that I decided I was going to start my my own biography with it, is that moment where he looks to the camera, tells that story, and then turns around, walks into the lobby, and we realize that this is where he's going to be playing with Keith Richards and Eric Clapton and Etta James and Julian Lennon and Robert Cray that night to celebrate an incredible career that changed the face of popular music.
The film tells us that Chuck Berry learned certain things about the world and maybe gained certain gifts from his parents, his dad, who was a contractor, and his mom, who I think was a school teacher or a school principal. Explain what he took from each of his parents into his professional life.
Sure. Well, his father was, as you said, he was a contractor. He obviously kept the family going very well during the Depression. And I think what Chuck got from him was just that tenacity and that work ethic that stood him in such great stead when he became a professional musician. From his mother, as you said, she was a qualified school teacher as well as a musician, and his father was I believe, in the choir at the Antioch Baptist Church, which was in the Ville itself. But he got two things from his mother, I believe. First of all, was his music. Well, partly was his musical ability, which was enhanced by his sister's Lucy's education as a or training as a mezzo soprano, classically trained mezzo soprano. But also, his mother, I think, gave him his lifelong interest in language and in poetry. And I think it's worth noting that Chuck's youngest brother was named Paul Lawrence Dunbar Berry after the great African poet. So I think he got both of those things from his parents.
We're told that that Chuck Berry picked up the guitar at the age of 13, that, of course, kind of paves the way for what follows. I noticed in your biography of him, when you talk about his struggles in high school, and I think he ultimately drops out, a couple of opera names leapt out because I'm an opera fan. So he went to Sumner High School, which is where Grace Bunbury went, a very, very important opera star who eventually won the Kennedy Center Honors, and Robert McFerrin, the first black man to sing at the Met and the father of Bobby McFerrin. They were more sort of typical musicians of Sumner High School. Chuck Berry would have been very much on the periphery because he was, in a sense, listening to a different siren. What do we know about the earliest music making of Chuck Berry while he was still a young teenager?
Well, Chuck recounts the story in the autobiography of his playing Jay McShann's Confessing Blues at some high school function, much to the annoyance and horror of the school faculty. I at that point too, I think Chuck is starting to really steep himself in two great musical traditions, which would have been regarded as just not worthy of really being played by the teachers of the school. One of which, of course, is R&B tradition, which he drew from with McShann's Confessing the Blues, but also I think at that point Chuck was very heavily listening to what was then regarded as hillbilly music, country and western, call it. And so I think, you know, what Chuck has is this background, this understanding of these two genres, and as Elvis Presley and Sam Phillips did down the Mississippi in Memphis in the early 1950s, so Chuck did upriver in St. Louis, and bring those two genres of music together and make them into what we would now call rock and roll.
As we've mentioned, Chuck Berry does drop out of high school. He does not graduate. He, I think, ends up heading off to L.A. with some friends, but they run out of money in Kansas City. Explain to our listeners what happens next.
At that point, on the way back from Kansas City, I think the story goes that their car broke down and they had held up a motorist and basically carjacked a car and were then pulled over by the Missouri police, state police, who turned them in, and they eventually, or Chuck eventually, got a prison sentence. I believe it was 10 years, although it was eventually reduced. And that began a lifelong pattern of his having trouble with the authorities and being in prison for various offenses. And again, I'm sure, you know, he says something like the trial took a little 10 minutes or so. And, you know, one can imagine a poor black kid in a white system just being railroaded right through. And I'm sure that is one of those incidents in his life that really made him distrustful of others.
Sentenced to 10 years, but released after three, released on his 21st birthday.
That's right.
And we see in the film that actually from that point on, for those next few years, Chuck Berry is able to put a respectable life together for himself, getting married, working construction, and so on, but not especially happy. He had obviously higher aspirations than that.
Yes, I would agree with that. And you see him kind of flitting from job to job. He was a hairdresser at one point. He was a building caretaker. And he worked at one of the local factories, which during the 1940s was became a munitions factory for the war effort. And so, yeah, he's really kind of going from job to job, and then finally he starts to get some paid gigs, particularly over the river in East St. Louis, and he starts to realize that perhaps this is a means of earning money and perhaps even supporting his family.
We're speaking with Bruce Pegg, who is featured in the PBS film about Chuck Berry for the PBS series In Their Own Words. The film is going to be airing tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. So it is a crucial encounter with an amazing pianist by the name of Johnny Johnson that really sets kind of a new chapter in motion for Chuck Berry. Explain this encounter and the Cosmo Club and what made them such an electrifying combination, musically speaking.
So the story goes that that Johnny invited Chuck to sit in on a New Year's Eve, I think it's 1952, a New Year's Eve show at the Cosmopolitan Club in East St. Louis. And by various accounts, that temporary arrangement eventually became permanent. I think because, Johnny, as you say, was a fabulous pianist and, well steeped in the boogie-woogie tradition of piano playing. But Chuck was able to bring to that that arrangement just this an incredible ability as a live performer, even then. And Johnny has told stories in about, you know, Chuck performing or actually sort of acting out lyrics to songs, much to the amusement of the crowd. And that's when I think, you know, Chuck brought in the more country elements to blend with Johnny's boogie-woogie playing. Eventually, of course, Chuck takes over. Johnny, sadly, was, for various reasons, not really interested in developing a career as such. I think he just would have been happy just playing clubs and bars his entire life. But Chuck had much greater ambitions, and particularly thought that it would be a great idea for them to actually record some of Chuck's original music. And so it was Chuck and not Johnny in the end that went to Chess Records in Chicago and persuaded them to record his song Maybelline. And at that point, of course, Chuck had really become the de facto leader of Johnny's band.
Hmm. Tell us more about this small record company, Chess Records, and sort of what their philosophy was and what set them apart from other more famous record labels of the time.
Well, being an independent record, a small independent label, they could be a little bit more adventurous in what they were doing. The bigger labels were really catering to a white audience and not really paying much attention to what was being played or what was being bought by black music fans. And so Chess could take an enormous risk on an act like Chuck Berry. They, of course, had made their reputation in the late 40s and early 50s, recording blues musicians, including Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and so on. And so, they were able to sort of experiment with this new thing. Phil Chess, one of the two brothers that ran the label, heard Maybelline for the first time and realized that it had the big beat and lyrics about young love and it talked about automobiles, so how could it fail among the teenage audience? And so they released Maybelline, convinced Alan Freed, the famous New York disc jockey, to play it on his show in New York City. And of course, you know, that back in the day, as you probably know, being in radio yourself, the AM signals could reach massive distances, and so all of a sudden that song was being played to white teenagers in their hundreds of thousands, and they immediately fell in love with it and went out and bought it.
By the way, I'm fuzzy on the details, but I know the film says something about the genesis of this song and its title, Maybelline, which was not its original title. Can you remind me about that?
Yeah, Chuck Berry had actually based the song on an old country and western song called Ida Red, but one of the Chess brothers told him, well, you can't really use that title because there's already a song of that name. And the story goes that somebody went into the bathroom at the recording studio and found an empty or a bottle of the women's cosmetic, and came back and said, hey, we should call it Maybelline. by pure chance, that's how that song got named.
Fantastic. It's an amazing song, of course, and it becomes this absolutely gigantic hit. You've already mentioned the famous figure of Alan Freed, who helped propel this song to the gigantic success that it was, but in a way that now most people would find really objectionable. Explain kind of what the arrangement was with Alan Freed and what ultimately angered Chuck Berry so much.
So the back in the day, and I suppose even now, we would call that payola. It's pay-for-play scheme. And I'm sure the Chess brothers paid handsomely for airtime on Freed's radio show. At the same point, they also encouraged Alan to play the song by naming him as one of the co-authors of the song. The song eventually came out. It was credited to Chuck Berry, who was the sole author of the song. Al Freed and another gentleman named Russ Fratto, who we assume had some business dealings with the Chess family. And that really angered Chuck, because obviously he realized that he had been cheated out of some of the publishing money. And the interesting thing that probably people that aren't massively interested or massively knowledgeable about the music industry is that publishing is really where the money is. Record sales will come and go, and generally the artists will only get a fraction of a percentage of the sales of a record. And sometimes even back in Chuck's day, they would even just not even be paid for sales and just be paid a flat fee for playing on the record itself. But publishing goes on forever, and any time the song is used and played on the air or in a movie or anything like that, that's where the author gets tremendous amounts of money. And what that led to, Greg, was Chuck decided that he was going to take charge of his own publishing. Originally, Chess's publishing company, Arc Music, administered the publishing for that particular song and several of the songs that followed it. But in 1958, Chuck said, "I'm going to start up my own publishing company," and took charge of his own publishing, which throughout the years made him a pretty wealthy man.
Hmm. He, tries to take charge of things and discovers that he can make much more money by performing live, but he finds even in those cases that sometimes he is not being paid. I mean, that the people that are arranging things are booking them for thousands of dollars a performance, and he's making hundreds of dollars from that. And so it leads to one of the funniest lines in the film, which is when Chuck Berry is asked what his advice is to a young aspiring musician, and his first bit of advice is major in math. So
absolutely.
So ultimately, Chuck Berry is able to kind of take over more and more of, in a sense, the professional reins of his life, begins to make the kind of money that he should make, and he produces hit after hit after hit, and then crash. It all comes to an end in Scandal. Explain to our listeners the scandal that brought his meteoric rise pretty much to a complete standstill.
Well, what happens is late in 1959, Chuck meets a young Apache Indian woman named Janice Escalante, and while he's on the road down south, and he brings her back to St. Louis to work for him in his club. He had a small club in St. Louis called Club Bandstand. Well, as events unfolded, it turns out, number one, that the young lady had lied to him and told him that she was 18 when in fact she was 14. But more important, the federal authorities, once they started investigating, charged Chuck with a violation of the Mann Act, which was an old piece of legislation that was initially intended to stop sex trafficking and white slavery, as it's been called. That was the intent of the act, but the wording of the act basically enabled the federal authorities to entrap anybody that had taken any member of the opposite sex across the state lines for, quote-unquote, the intent of immoral purposes. So after several trials, one of which was thrown out on appeal because the judge had made a number of racist comments during the trial, Chuck was eventually imprisoned for the scandal. But the interesting thing to me, Greg, is that, Chuck had such an indomitable spirit, and he was sentenced, I think, to 5 years and now only served about 20-something-odd months of that sentence. But when he comes out at the end of 1963, he is raring to go. He immediately leaves prison, and within days is back on stage in Detroit. He's written songs in prison. But more interesting in addressing the point that you made earlier, not only do aspiring musicians need to learn math, but they also need to learn the legal side of things and the business side of things. And those are all things that he learned in various courses that he took while he was in prison. So when he comes out, he's actually, well enough, more well-equipped to handle his career than he probably ever was. And the interesting thing is 1964 comes around, and you've got the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and the Beach Boys all playing his music. He's writing The Crest of the Raven, writes some of the best songs of his entire career, You Never Can Tell, Promised Land, Nadine, just incredible songs that put him right back in the spotlight, and don't hold him back in the way that I would argue that Jerry Lee Lewis was held back in his career when he married his cousin. So an interesting sort of cautionary tale that had a much better ending than it probably could have.
I think it's Chuck Berry quoted in the film as saying that I seem to screw up in a major way about every 17 years or so, and indeed, he had not had a major screw-up for the last time. I mean, he'd had that armed robbery thing, and then the morals charges thing, and then once again, he gets into legal trouble. Explain what the trouble is this time around.
Sure. So in the 1970s, of course, I mentioned earlier that Chuck had been ripped off a lot in his life, and so a lot of his bookings were made as a cash only deal. He would sign a contract, as you said, for one amount and get paid in by check by that amount, but there would also be money exchange between him and between the promoter and he. Very often in a brown paper bag and just cash only. And he had several dealings, one in this country with a promoter named Ralph Nader, not Ralph Nader, Richard Nader, beg pardon, who promoted a number of shows at Madison Square Garden in the early 1970s that Chuck had arranged that kind of deal with Chuck. Also, Chuck had gone to tour England in, I think, right around 1973, too, and had insisted on getting paid in English pounds, which are not exactly easy to smuggle out of the country in exchange for American dollars, as he was later find out. As happens to, I think, everybody eventually, Greg, the IRS catches up with him and imprisoned him for tax evasion in 1979. And then later on in the late 80s, early 90s, he becomes a part of a class action suit where a number of women accuse him of installing cameras in the bathroom of a restaurant that he owned, taking photographs of them, which was never actually proven, but he did settle that one out of court. But yeah, he was a character that always walked on the edges, and every once in a while that caught up with him.
Hmm. We do, by the way, meet his charming wife. I mean, the woman he married, I forget the year, but they were married until Chuck Berry's death, and she was asked at some point in the film, why did you stand by him? Especially given some of the things he was accused of doing, and she simply accepted who he was and what he represented. She's an amazing woman.
Yes, I think so too. And what that speaks to, Greg, and something that I try to touch on in my biography is that there's really two sides to Chuck Berry. There's, in fact, people use the name Charles when they are close to him, his family, his close business associates and friends. But you move out of that circle and he's Chuck Berry. He is the performer, the public personality. And I think Samantha, his wife Toddy, as he used to call her, accepted Charles and as the family man, the breadwinner, the provider, and ignored Chuck, basically, and ignore the public side of his life.
Hmm. I do want to give you a chance to describe this amazing occasion in 1986, Chuck Berry's 60th birthday. It's so amazing to think that he lived 30 years past that 60th birthday. But in 1986, a very special occasion and concert is put together at that famous Fox Theater where he and his family had been turned away when he was just 10 or 11. And this is an amazing undertaking and should have been nothing but a glorious occasion. And in many ways, it was a glorious occasion, but also one, like so many aspects of Chuck Berry's life and career, racked with controversy. Explain to our listeners what this event was all about and what one sees when one watches the film that was created around this occasion.
Yeah, I think you pretty much described it. It was a 60th birthday concert. It was supposed to be an all-star celebration. And at the same time, the movie director Taylor Hackford decided he was going to film it for the movie that eventually became Hail and Roll, which is a marvelous movie, and I encourage anybody to track it down. Because what you'll see in that movie is this constant conflict between Chuck, the director Taylor Hackford, and Keith Richards, the guitarist for the Rolling Stones, who had taken on the unenviable task of becoming the music director for the occasion. And Chuck just butted heads with everybody. He would, as stories that I've heard, he would show up for filming some of the little segments that accompanied the performance, including a segment at the old Cosmopolitan Club, where he would show up and just kind of stand on the sidelines until somebody asked him to be on camera, at which point he would ask for money. And then with Keith, the two, you know, Chuck just did things his own way, and he had done it that way for years. And Keith is asking him to do things, change his guitar tone, and do things that would be amenable to the movie itself. And Chuck just stubbornly refused to do those things, to the point where he and Keith almost come to blows in the movie. It's an amazing moment. And it was just, you know, as you said, what should have been a tremendous celebration turns out to be this almost like a train wreck, which the fact that the performances are so good in the movie and well worth watching in their own right is a testimony, I think, to Keith Richards and the professionalism of everybody around.
I think it's in the film that we're told, or maybe Keith Richards himself tells us, that he wanted to reacquaint Chuck Berry with his own genius. That is, Keith Richards is trying to help Chuck Berry be his very best at a point in his career when maybe that was not always what happened. Can you just say a word about that? That's such an intriguing idea, but it also helps us understand why things got so tense between these two great musicians.
Yeah, prior to the movie and even after the movie, as a part of this whole effort to try and take total control of his music career, Chuck basically fired all of his band, including Johnny Johnson, and decided that he was going to play shows with pickup bands around the country. There was a good monetary reason for that. He could just pay them union scale and not have to worry about their behavior on off stage. And what that led to was performances of, shall we say, variable quality. If the band on a given night knew his material and knew it well, knew the keys that it was in, was not obvious to most musicians, then the shows would go well. And when they didn't, the shows would be awful. And so, you know, what Keith tried to do, I think, in that movie is to present Chuck with a band, including, ironically, Johnny Johnson, who Keith had found in St. Louis, who wasn't playing piano any longer. But to help Chuck play with an all-star band and great musicians to enable him to understand just how amazing music was that he'd come 30 years earlier.
And speaking of 30 years, as I said, Chuck Berry ultimately lives 30 years longer after this important concert honoring him. He dies in 2017 at the age of 90. He is one among the very first musicians to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. By the time he died, what is your sense of what he knew about his importance and whether or not he was finally given the respect that he deserved?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Greg, because he, I believe, was very humble about his accomplishments. He only ever viewed his music career as a utilitarian thing, as something that just he did to make money, and never really viewed himself as being a tremendous figure in the music world. But of course, his music, as we said at the beginning of the show here, influenced the Beatles and the Stones, and then much later on, people like Bruce Springsteen and Bob Seger and John Mellencamp in the 70s, and countless bands in that time. One of the problems, with Chuck was that his career as a recording artist essentially ended in 1977, even though there was a posthumous release a couple of years ago, which kind of put him out of the limelight, and just playing shows over and over and over just really did not make him a household name to a lot of people in the current generation. But I think his legacy is assured from what you said, by being in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, from the influence that he had, and my favorite example of how important Chuck Berry's music is we must never forget that in 1977, when the Voyager spacecraft was launched to be the first spacecraft to possibly come into contact with an alien civilization. On board those spacecraft were two golden discs that had samples of every great artistic achievement, artwork, music, along with samples of sounds and pictures from Earth. And on those two discs is Johnny B. Goode. And that says to me that Johnny B. Goode is up there with one of the greatest achievements of human artistic endeavor, and to me that says it all.
The film on the PBS series In Their Own Words, devoted to Chuck Berry, will air tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. And featured in the film is Bruce Pegg, whose biography about Chuck Berry, published back in 2002, is titled Brown-Eyed Handsome Man, The Life and Times of Chuck Berry. Bruce Pegg, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me on The Morning Show. I appreciated your valuable contribution to this fascinating film, and it was great to catch up with you. Thank you so much. Best wishes.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it is Dr. Art Sear, who joins us for his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of various current events and issues. On Wednesday, Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. Her guest with her is P.J. Leisch, who is from the Entomology Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about how you can make your lawn and your garden a more inviting place for insects. On Thursday, a preview of Racine's Starving Artist Fair. And on Friday, a conversation with Ben Kaczynski, a young man from Oak Creek, who has just earned the national title